The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Yeah, it's Martin Davis, President and CEO of Westchester, which is one of the Nuveen affiliates, farmland management business. We manage about 2 million acres globally, about $8.2 billion worth of assets. I've been in the agricultural investment industry for a little bit over 25 years.
And this is Mike Consul, and we welcome Martin Davies to the program. We have really not done a lot of coverage of agriculture with podcasts or videos, so I was quite excited to get Martin scheduled for this podcast today. And as Martin said, part of Nuveen, Westchester Agriculture Assets is a unit of Nuveen, which is a formerly TIAA, one of the monsters of the industry and quite heavily invested in agriculture. Martin, welcome to the program.
Thanks, pleasure to be here.
So let's start with the current state of farmland and what the sweet spot is right now. What would you consider the sweet spot in farmland or ag investing for the next year or two or even 5 years? What looks to be the real strong suit of the asset class right now?
Well, Mike, we have a global approach, Mike, and I think I wouldn't specifically focus on any sweet spots overall. I think that all sectors of the industry have got a pretty strong future, and that's underpinned by demographics, population growth, more discerning diet. We believe a diversified approach is pretty important because agriculture is subject to intervention by politicians, regulation, and so on. And of course, it's primary production, so we kind of get away from the risks of the weather and price volatility as well, commodity price volatility. So, good example right now where we've got the impact of tariffs and trade war in the US. But I think if I had to pick on one particular area where there are undoubtedly quite a few interesting opportunities, which I think maybe have been a little bit overdone at the moment, but there is a lot of interest in permanent crops where you're following some of the trends in food and more discerning diet. So if you look at things like avocado consumption, tree nut consumption, blueberries, those are all segments which there's a health aspect to, and consumption has really increased significantly over and above the general trends that exist in other agricultural commodities.
Let's talk about that investment approach that Nuveen takes, or your organization as a part of Nuveen takes. From a macroeconomic level and a demographic or geographic level, all of which I think come under the rubric really of macroeconomics, what are some of those macroeconomics or demographic trends or geographic considerations that you take into account?
I mentioned very quickly there before about population growth. So the FAO predict 9.7 billion people by 2050. So food production between now and 2050 needs to double to cope with that population growth. It's not just population growth, it's higher calorific intake, particularly in Asia and Africa. So the FAO predict that by 2050 there'll be less than 5% of population will be eating less than 2,500 calories today. Currently that is 35% of population. So any investment in agriculture, investment in farmland, in our view, is fundamentally underpinned by that. I think if you look at things from a country perspective, there are countries which have free trade agreements and are geographically positioned well to capitalize on some of that growth, in particular in Asian countries. We have been a significant investor in Australia for 10 years now. Australia has really benefited from markets in China, Japan, and Malaysia, the Philippines. So I would highlight that as being one area of interest. But if we look across our platform globally, we do see the same theme and the same opportunities existing right the way across the platform. We're invested in seven different countries globally. If you look at South America, soybean production in Brazil has increased significantly over the last 10 years, and that has been driven by increased consumption of soybean in China. As the Chinese population consume more meat, the pig industry in China has been very strong. So they're looking for feed grains to feed that increasing livestock herd.
Now, my understanding is, correct me if I'm wrong, but China has been buying a lot of, or at least leasing a lot of property in Africa. They're looking to grow their own soybeans, which they import a ton of them from the United States. I mean, many millions of tons from the United States. And it's a shorter route, and it gives them more control. Is that the kind of decision that a nation makes, a very hungry, very large, 1.3 billion person nation makes, that suddenly creates a situation where you start making adjustments in your portfolio?
I wouldn't necessarily say that we would focus on the demographics of what's happening in only one country. So without that, China's had a big influence. But if we look at population, India comes into play as well. Indeed, you would have to make the assumption that if the Chinese government felt that they were able to produce that food domestically, they would probably prefer to do that. But of course, many parts of China have got significant problems with water availability, degradation of soils and that sort of thing. So I think their play and what they do is a mixture of things. I think they'll always look to procure commodities. And they indeed in the last 10 years have set up a state-owned business to procure agricultural commodities globally, and they become a player in some of these, a significant player in some of these markets. So I think a combination of domestic production, some situations where they actually lease or buy land and actually operate that themselves, or buy commodities in the market is really the blend of what they'll do. But I think it's wrong to just focus on one country. And if we look globally, China has without doubt been the biggest driver in the last 10 to 15 years. But if we look where the trajectory on population growth is, pretty much every significant country in Africa has got population growth in excess of 3% year on year. So I think Africa itself will become a very strong force, and other Southeast Asian countries as well for that matter.
So let me ask you about that population growth. You're talking about nearly 10 billion people. We're on track to get to nearly 10 billion human beings on the earth before there's supposed to be a population decline, but that's some time off. There are people, and I don't know if they know what they're talking about, Martin, but there's some people who say the only way we're going to feed all those people is to have a second green revolution. And people are working towards that, obviously, all the time. We're trying to innovate and get there. To begin with, do you concur that there has to be a lot of innovation in ag technology to meet the needs of the human family? What are the prospects of a second green revolution? Where is that going to come from? I know that's a complex question, but you've been at it for decades, so I trust that you've got an informed answer. Martin, what do you say?
And look at the human population. We evolved from hunter-gatherers. We went through the Industrial Revolution, and in the 1960s and 1970s, we had the Green Revolution, which was largely driven by Nobel Prize winner Norman Borlaug with the new varieties of wheat and rice and that sort of thing. And if you look at corn yield, bushels per acre has increased over that period. There are two, if not three, clear stages in that process. I do think we are, if we're not already into it, we're on the cusp of what I would call a data revolution, so a fourth revolution in agriculture. I think by the very nature of agriculture as an activity, there are so many variables involved where you have agricultural activity interfacing with soil, climate, and that sort of thing. So it is an industry which really does, because of this variability, lend itself to data capture and using that data to inform decision-making processes and come up with prescriptions in production. So I really do think we are on the point of a significant revolution. So the naysayers and those Malthusian people would say that we have major problems, but I think technology is going to advance significantly. But it's not necessarily just increasing yields, it's the efficiency of conversion of inputs into outputs, which is what we're the key part where we see. I think we will continue to see growth in physical productivity, but more importantly, we'll see an improvement in the efficiency of conversion of inputs into outputs. And from a sustainability point of view for the planet, that's a pretty critical part of all of this.
Let me ask you
maybe just to comment on a specific thing which I think is very relevant there from a data revolution point of view. So we've seen in recent years mapping of the genomes of most of the main crops that are grown agriculturally, so that having that understanding of where you've historically had natural mutations and the ability to go in with CRISPR technology to actually edit genes and to be able to manipulate those mutations really is a game changer. So last year we saw the wheat genome fully mapped. Corn and soybeans have been a little bit earlier than that, but that's an example of data and the technology around it which really can change things.
Yeah, it's very exciting. A lot of exciting technologies coming down the pike. Let's talk a little bit about whether you differentiate between farmland investing and agriculture investing. Is there a difference between the two? How do you define them, farmland investing versus agricultural investing?
I think there's a very clear difference. So if we think about the institutional investor population, agriculture's very much been a relatively new asset class, and I think there has been a lack of understanding in certain areas. We would consider what we do as a business very much being farmland investing. So we're looking to get the characteristics that farmland has demonstrated historically from a return point of view. So it's a very good inflation hedge, low correlation with the economic cycle. And we're looking to get those characteristics. It's a very good portfolio diversifier because of that inflation hedge. But that's farmland. If you start talking about investing in agriculture generally, that could be anything from investing in some of the upstream and downstream activities that surround the agricultural supply chain. So upstream, I'm talking about processing businesses. So if I think about some of the investments that our owner, TIA General Account, has made historically, they've invested in almond processing, for example. And at the other end, you could be looking at investing in input businesses, so whether they be seed businesses or fertilizers or even machinery, the inputs that the agricultural cycle wants. If we are looking at a situation where the entity that investors are coming into is actually taking the risk on the crop, it employs the people, it owns the machinery, you can almost look at it in a sort of agricultural private equity type angle. So you've got operating, you've got some land ownership maybe, so it's a wider risk base than core and fundamental approach, which is buying farmland, and in the case of row crops, leasing that land out, and in the case of permanent crops, so tree nuts, wine grapes, citrus, avocados, actually operating those higher value assets where it's possible to add value, but operating it through outsourcing the field operations to a specialist crop manager or a contractor who that arrangement being through means that the investment entity doesn't have some of those risks associated with employing people and owning machinery. So there's many different things within the agricultural investing universe. Farmland is at one end. And just to think of some examples here to illustrate what we're talking about, we would not consider buying an operational business in Ukraine as being a farmland investment because there's a moratorium on land ownership in Ukraine, so any business there is just leasing that farmland in. You've got operational activity. That is very different from a risk profile point of view to the foundation of our business activities, which is buying good quality land and leasing it out to entrepreneurial tenants, say, in the Midwest of the U.S. or in the south of the U.S. or in Australia for that matter. So it's a very big spectrum, really, that could capture the, that could come under the banner of agricultural investing. Farmland is one small part of that.
So where or how does farmland and agriculture investing fit into a diversified portfolio, Martin? And could you answer this from a couple of different standpoints? There's the institutional portfolio, and then there's the, say, the individual portfolio, the high net worth or ultra high net worth individual or family. So, and I don't know if they're synonymous. I don't know if you would say they serve the same role and in the same percentage and whatnot. But how would you answer that question about, really, where does farmland investing fit in the portfolio and at what percentage?
The way I would see the type of investors that you've described looking at farmland, I think I'd see them looking very differently. If we look at the majority of institutional investor clients that we have, they are interested in capital growth, but where you have retirement schemes that have liabilities, annual cash generation is a pretty important component, part of what they're looking for as well. So I think the tendency we see is for institutional investors to be maybe more focused on cash yields right now, and I guess that's just a reflection of the marketplace generally and where people can go to get good cash generation. Whereas on the other hand, I think a retail-oriented investor maybe is looking more for capital growth. So in the portfolios that we construct, we do have good cash generation, and we do also have capital growth as well, and that does vary across the locations where we're making investments and also the type of investment. So if we're talking about a permanent crop investment where you've got significant value in biological assets, those biological assets need to be replaced over time. So an almond tree will last 15 to 20 years, where after you have to replant. So you effectively, with permanent crops, you have a depreciating biological asset, and that can be counted by the land value, which we would expect to see appreciating over time. So it's possible to put very different portfolios together, but those two type of clients would, in my view, have a quite different outlook on things, with the institutional client being more focused on cash generation. Where does it fit into a portfolio? Many of our clients have dedicated real asset portfolios. So within that era, they would include infrastructure, they'd include real estate, farmland, and timber. And when you talk to investment consultants, there are some fairly varied views on what component that should make up in an institutional portfolio. But very typically, we see some of the early adopters and the people that have been investing in farmland and timber for quite some time would see that could make up as much as 3-5% of their portfolio. I think from a retail investor point of view, there maybe isn't nearly as much sophistication in thinking about how much of this investment type should I look to have in my portfolio, and maybe with quite different risk profiles and appetites as well. I think a core farmland investment maybe isn't quite as interesting to a retail investor who would possibly be happier to take a slightly higher risk profile and maybe a higher return that would come differently from a core farmland type strategy.
Now, you mention real assets, but there's a lot of investors who don't have real asset or even alternative components to their portfolio. They're really kind of stuck on the whole, two-dimensional stock and bond portfolio. So let's talk about diversification a little bit, both within the agricultural sleeve or the farmland sleeve. What can you tell us about diversification within agriculture investing? How many different components does there need to be for it to be diversified? Because obviously you're not going to put all your chips on one horse or one crop, I should say. But then there's also the question of the role it plays in an overall portfolio for diversification of the overall portfolio. And it's noticeably lacking in many portfolios, particularly in the private wealth space. So again, I'm asking a compound question there, Martin, but if you could sort your way through that one, what about that? Maybe start with the diverse, what if you're putting together a sleeve within a portfolio for farmland investing, what are maybe some of the components of that constitute diversification?
To simplify that, I think I would look at that in four different ways. So I talked earlier about the rationale in diversifying in agriculture. So it's primary production, weather risk, price volatility, government intervention and regulation. And of course, there's political things like land ownership that change, rulings around land ownership that change over time as well. So I think the way we would look at things is we would certainly look for, at a minimum, four different approaches from a diversification point of view. So diversification by geography, so I'm talking about country, but also within country, diversification by crop type, diversification by the way in which you operate the assets. And I think an important thing to consider in a farmland investment is diversification from a water point of view as well. So properties where you have dry land, so unirrigated, or properties where you have irrigation is a component part of the investment. So I'd start with those fundamental four different levels, and let's just illustrate some of the examples there. The land, the 2 million acres of land that we manage globally, that land is growing over 35 different crop types, so you've got very good diversification there. And if we look at the current market situation, if I was an investor in farmland and I'd only invested in corn and soybeans in the US, I think with the current dynamics from a market point of view, I might well be quite concerned. But if you're invested in wine grapes, citrus, avocado, wheat, walnuts, canola, cotton, sugarcane, you've got a spread of cropping influenced by different markets, which are at different positions at any particular point in time. So it just gives you a natural inbuilt hedge. So those are the four fundamental starting points that I'd look at.
Now, let me ask you about, do you have any sense of what percentage of portfolios out there, not counting the ones that are under your roof, because obviously you guys promote this because it's what you guys do, and it's sound investing, the diversification and whatnot. But as you look across the landscape, the investing landscape, do you have any sense for what percentage of portfolios actually have farmland or agriculture components to them? I guess what I'm getting at here, Martin, is there a huge swath of investors out there who you guys are still looking to reach out to, you and a lot of other people who are in the space, to try to get them involved in farmland and agriculture to your benefit and theirs, for that matter? You have any sense of that percentage?
Yeah, undoubtedly, if we look at farmland as an asset class, it's relatively immature. There's been far more talk from an institutional investor point of view about investing in land, farmland or agriculture for that matter, than actually doing anything. And I think the number, I think, which really clearly illustrates that, so that there's an estimate that the total U.S. farmland market is worth about $2.5 trillion, and currently less than 2% of that market is institutionally owned. So it's a very small segment from an ownership point of view, and let's not forget that wherever you go globally, agriculture does fundamentally remain very much a family or family-owned business-oriented activity. So I think it's wrong to say that great swathes of the world's best farmland are owned by institutions. And of course, there's been institutional ownership of farmland for a long, long time. If you go to the UK, some of the Oxford and Cambridge colleges have owned land for 500 years or so, and okay, maybe in the first instance that was given as a donation by somebody associated with the college. So I think it's still relatively small. Certainly from an investor point of view, there are early adopters who are very familiar with the asset class and understand, but I think we still are involved in a lot of educational activity. Not only describing the fundamentals, but really sharing our experience on return history and how assets are performed. But I think if I consider where we are right now, we're late in the economic cycle. There's a lot of talk about a coming recession, but if we look historically at this, the correlation or lack of any correlation between farmland and traditional investments, it really must be a good place to think about putting your money now. So maybe that will be a driver that will bring new investors to the farmland or agricultural space generally.
Let's talk about returns, because I'll tell you what, returns will bring investors around. What has historically, and I think we need to really talk recent history, how has farmland performed? What kind of returns have we seen? And maybe talk a little bit about why that hasn't been maybe more persuasive to investors to get on board, or what it's going to take to get more investors to get on board. But what about those returns, both historically, Martin, and also as you look forward, what's the anticipation?
One of the numbers that I can give you, which I think is a good illustration of history, if you look at USDA data and you look at the period between 1966 and 2016, the total return from farmland in the US has been 11%, 5% of that from annual income, 6% from capital appreciation. And of course, remember that number is at a property level. So if you're looking at structuring investments and some of the associated costs, you're going to be trimming a little bit off that return, but that's a pretty good indication of what US farmland has performed like historically. Are we necessarily going to see the same level of returns going forward? I think in a diversified portfolio, and keep in mind that number is looking at the US generally, so it captures permanent crops, it captures row crops. We are likely over a good time horizon to see similar levels of return, and I think from an investor perspective, in a core farmland strategy, it is not unreasonable to accept a 7-9% total return, 3-4% of that coming from cash, and the rest coming from capital appreciation. But that's a strategy that's got pretty low operating exposure and low operating risk. So the more you adjust that portfolio, the more you look towards taking the full operating risk, you would expect to see returns increase.
You know, Martin, they talk a lot today, they being managers and investors, about this yield-starved environment that we're in. And with those kinds of returns that we've been seeing in farmland and agriculture, you would think they'd say, hey, look, this is an asset class that's producing. So if we're yield starved, there are some sweet spots here. Why not the rush? Why not the stampede to the farm to start pulling some of these returns into their portfolios and some of this appreciation in their portfolios. What is the hesitation? What do you think is the biggest impediment to farmland not becoming a bigger component to investment portfolios?
Let me just develop a theme that I just introduced there about agriculture being a very family or family business oriented industry. I think if you think about the investment industry and institutional expectation, there probably has been a significant gulf between, let's call it, the rustic nature of things at a farmland level, and what happens generally in the investment world, the sophistication that exists in the investment world. So I think that to me leads to a situation where it hasn't been an asset class which has been particularly easy to access. Most of the transactions that take place that we do are off-market transactions, and that really does depend on having people on the ground in the locations where you're making investments. So in a situation where historically there have been a limited number of managers who have the correct institutional status, it has been a difficult asset class to access. And when you combine with that this educational situation that I referenced and really the lack of understanding that investors have, I think that to me is quite simply what has really slowed the development of the asset class. So our business is really based around having people on the localities where we're making investments. So we have 120 people in the seven countries that we're making investments. They're local people, they're farming background, they have the contact at a local level, they have access to off-market transactions. And I think Westchester being part of the wider Nuveen business, that does bring to us the Nuveen investment industry sophistication and institutional or retail capital experience. And I think that's really why we haven't seen more activity. It's been difficult for investors to access just because of the nature of the industry. And I'm sure I'm not sure we're going to see a rush, but I really do think because of the characteristics of the asset class, we are going to see increased interest, and maybe we will be in 5 or 10 years' time in the same places where timber is today, because there's no doubt timber is more recognized as an asset class from an institutional perspective, definitely.
And maybe what will drive that that evolution is agricultural technology, or ag tech as it's called. There's a lot of innovations being made. You've alluded to the genome and the ability to manipulate crops. There's GPS and driverless tractors. There's all kinds of different ag tech innovations that are taking place right now. I'm sure you're very in tune with that. So I wanted to ask you, what innovations do you see that you think are going to be particularly powerful, have a particularly powerful impact on ag production and profitability? Now, you mentioned the genome, so maybe that's one of them. What else?
So let me just give you 8 headlines which are undoubtedly relevant from an evolution and in a lot of respects disruptive within the agricultural sector as well, but we do need that disruption. Virtual reality, artificial intelligence, 3D printing, robotic mechanization, drones, remote sensors, blockchain, and augmented reality. So there's 8 technologies there which undoubtedly are going to change agriculture and probably change it beyond all recognition. All of those technologies are connected via the Internet of Things, and the ability to take data and run that through logarithmic models, come up with predictions, come up with forecasts of what climate can do, undoubtedly is going to change the industry significantly.
Now, we recently had something in the magazine, as a matter of fact, about, I believe they're a new generation of tractors that have sensors that will tell you crops are not emerging evenly, if there's pests, if there's disease, If there's uneven watering, it's got all kinds of different. It basically serves the role of the farmer actually walking through the farmland and looking things over very closely and figuring out what's going on. But this is all done in an automated fashion. So right along the lines of what you're talking about, Martin, really exciting stuff, and it's reason for a lot of optimism. But then there's this countervailing force called Mother Nature. And a lot of people feel like we're Mother Nature's one of the biggest concerns we're going to have with climate change that is being talked about so much these days. How big a concern is climate change at this stage? What are scientists saying about higher temperatures and the effect on crops? And paradox of you have droughts, but at the same time we also get these enormous rainfalls that can flood crops and do damage to them. So how big a concern is climate change right now?
I think the thing, people get very focused on climate change, but I think it's the volatility of weather within that climatic change which is the most difficult thing, whether it be agriculture or any type of activity that has to be dealt with. You'll be well aware that the central part of the U.S. and the South has been extremely wet this year. To the USDA, information on plant in progress came out on Monday of this week, and we are significantly behind where we expect to be at this time of the year for corn and soybean planting, and that's just been driven by very, very high levels of rain. So volatility and the extremes, I think, is the challenging thing. People get very focused on the negative impact of climate change, but let's not forget that there will be areas that are positively influenced and positively benefit from that. Research that's been done by the University of Leeds in the UK suggests that the boreal region, which is the area as we move to northern latitudes, so that the cropping zone could move further north by about 1,200 kilometres over the next 100 years. So currently only 32% of that region falls into the category where there's sufficient growing degree days for crops because of freezing conditions in the winter. So there will be certain areas where things that haven't been grown historically will be grown. So look out, it'll be wine grapes in Finland before we know it. So there are positive changes as well. I think that's one of the things that we think is important in the investments that we make, is to invest in high quality farmland which has got reliable water source available. All the underwriting that we do includes analysis on the impact that climate change will have. So using models which are fed by the data that we were referring to earlier is data that's been captured and used in that process. So undoubtedly there are going to be some winners and losers here. And I think that the key thing from an investment point of view, agriculture, farmland, you need to be, it's a long-term business. So if you're making these investments, which you're anticipating being long-term investments, you need to be in the places that are not going to be impacted and also the places that are going to be positively impacted. Another example I frequently give people is if you look at the south of the UK, on the South Downs, you have the same terroir as you have in the Champagne region of France, so you have calcareous loam over chalk. So increasingly, there are vines being planted in the south of England on the basis that there is going to be the ability to produce high-quality wines there in the future. And there are indeed high-quality wines produced already.
It's an interesting point that you make about climate change and some of the positive effects it could have on agriculture. So let's just a couple more questions, Martin, and I'll let you go. I'm curious about what concerns you most right now about farmland and agriculture, that space these days. What is your biggest concern?
One of my main concerns, and I've got many concerns, but one of my one of my main concerns is I think if we look at agricultural activity, and this applies globally, we haven't been particularly good at looking after our most valuable resource, which is our soil. So that is intrinsic to land value. So it's something that we need to take very seriously. I think the level of knowledge and awareness has improved significantly, but that's something which does concern me. I think the other thing which is, of course, a concern, and there will potentially be places that will be positively impacted and some places will be negatively impacted, but is water availability. So right at the start of this interview, we were talking about permanent crop opportunities, so things that have been following dietary trends, avocados, table grapes, citrus, tree nuts are all things that grow in a Mediterranean climate, so essentially that is growing crops in a desert type environment or a very low rainfall environment which has high temperatures and high sunshine hours with the availability of water. So availability of water, and not only the availability, the quality of that water. And I think there are many areas globally where, whether it be urban activity or whether it be agricultural activity, we have not historically done perhaps as good a job as we should have done about looking after our natural capital. So I think natural capital and the understanding of exactly what natural capital is wrapped up in all of the things that are associated with farmland or, for that matter, timberland investment. So biodiversity, the value of the environment from a human population point of view, so people talk about ecosystem services, these are all things that come into play. So we do need to look after our natural capital better than we maybe have done historically. But I think with technology, with the level of sophistication and knowledge, I don't see that as being a major problem, but we haven't been perhaps quite so good. And I think that's what happens when you have an evolution through an industrial revolution type situation.
So on the flip side, what makes you most optimistic? What is your number one effect that you would point to that fills you with optimism about the future of agriculture?
You can't fail to be optimistic about an industry where you know that the consumption of your goods is going to double over the next 50 years. That's a pretty exciting thing to hear, and particularly when we know we have technology which can influence production. I think the other thing that makes me very excited about the industry, if we look at agriculture historically, it's not necessarily been the best industry from an attractiveness to an employee. So if I am somebody in high school or I'm in university right now, I think the one industry that I would just love to go and work in is agriculture, because maybe historically it's been considered to be a dirty type of industry, very mundane with a lot of manual tasks and so on. But a lot of those technologies that I'm talking about have the potential to revolutionize that. So it's an industry which needs data engineers, it needs IT people, it needs people that do analysis of data. So it's an industry, I think, the sophistication of which is going to change beyond all recognition, which I find that very, very exciting. My only regret in that is I'm 50 this year, so if I was 22 or 23 or maybe even 25, I think I'd be quite excited about the next 25 years for this industry.
Well, I'm with you, Martin. I'm into my 50s, but I'll tell you, one of the things that I really like about your comments during this podcast has been that tree nuts, avocados, blueberries, citrus are are the crops that are very strong right now and profitable. Those are all staples in my vegetarian diet. So keep pumping that money in there. Keep producing this stuff. I'll buy it, Martin, if you grow it. So I really appreciate your time. This was a really interesting walkthrough where agriculture stands right now. And I know that our managers and investors, when they hear this, are going to learn something new.
Let me just leave you with one statistic. So between 2005 and 2017, UK per capita consumption of blueberries increased tenfold, but it's still 40% lower than the US. So if I was a blueberry grower in South America, Peru or Chile or anywhere else for that matter, I'd be pretty excited.